Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Triangulation with Tom Merritt and Leo Laporte. Episode 33, recorded November 30th, 2011. Kevin Marks, Part 1. Triangulation is brought to you by Ford, featuring available Sync with My Ford Touch. Sync with My Ford Touch gets you to your destination with integrated turn-by-turn directions and directional arrows displayed on screen. Check it out on the 2012 Ford Focus and at Ford.com/technology. And by Netflix. Watch thousands of TV episodes and movies on your PC, Mac, iPad, iPhone, or TV instantly. All streamed directly to you, saving you time, money, and hassle. For your free 30-day trial, go to Netflix.com/twit. It's time for Triangulation, a fun show in which Tom Merritt and I put someone in the middle and quiz them, usually a person of interest, somebody who has something to say. I've worked in all the potential titles for this show.
Brainstorming titles, can you tell?
There's Tom Merritt. And that man in the middle is actually a guy we were interviewing on Triangulation a couple of months ago. In the middle of the interview, word came that Steve Jobs had passed away. And actually, Kevin very kindly stuck around and joined our coverage that night. But we didn't really get to talk to you, Kevin, about your history. So it's good to get you back. Kevin Marks, welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here again.
Are we going to include the first part of that episode as a bonus track?
We should. That's a great idea, yeah. Actually. Kevin has a very interesting checkered past. He's been on many of our shows because of that checkered past, because of all the things he's done. But it also
sounds like a killer or something.
Well, he is a person of interest. We just don't know what he's done something. We just don't know what it is. He was at Technorati. He's been at Apple. He has been at British Telecom. He is currently at Salesforce. But it all started at the BBC. Is that right, Kevin?
BBC is the first place I went to work when I left university, yes. And I was actually a video engineer initially, working on mobile recording audio and video stuff, repairing devices and getting stuff together. But then I joined this group called the Interactive Television Unit, which was, there was originally a thing in the BBC called the Doomsday Project. And if you don't know if you remember this, this was in 1986, the 900th anniversary of the Doomsday Book. They decided to come up with this idea of a project where they'd gather information from all over Britain and produce a computer version of it. So they had this sort of ridiculously ahead of its time system, which was a BBC Micro attached to a Philips LaserVision player, which had a SCSI interface, so you could get data out of the Laserdisc as well as video and audio. And so they built this sort of weird multimedia encyclopedia thing that was required this magic hardware, which they made a few thousand of them and gave them out to schools and libraries. So this is this sort of huge public service project. And when that finished in 86, this group was left at the BBC wondering what to do next. That was the Interactive Television Unit. And they were messing around at the edges of computers. There we go. There's a impressive piece of discovery there. Messing around with computers and video and trying to make the two fit together at the time where it wasn't quite possible to do much with it.
Look at the size of CDs in those days.
that's the Laserdisc, yes.
Good old Laserdisc.
They were ginormous back then. This was pre-CD, because CDs were around, I think, in 86.
There were CDs, and CD-ROMs were just starting. Actually, one of the things that I first worked on there was translating one of their discs from, that was called EcoDisc, which was it was like they took a camera to a nature reserve and walked around the nature reserve and took photographs in all directions. So it was kind of like Street View. You could walk around this nature reserve and turn around and look in different directions.
Is that a cartridge in that thing?
No. Where? Sorry.
Go back a little bit on that, because the keyboard. What is that? Is that
that AIV thing sticking out?
That's a slot you can. Yeah, you could stick things in. That was like a ROM expansion.
That's where you put the Space Invaders.
Look at this. I mean,
this is the BBC Micro. This is a 6502 processor.
This is the
original sort of. Again, BBC decided to get into computing, and they got Acorn to build this thing and promoted it to schools.
So this was. I remember that very well. Yeah. In fact, this, between the Sinclair and the BBC Micro, and the Acorn, there were a lot of people in Britain, at least, who cut their teeth on these inexpensive computers.
Yeah, I started out with a Commodore PET. I was.
We've got one of those next time you're here. Next time you're here, we'll show you our PET.
Or just watch TNT. It's behind IaaS every day.
That's right. So you were, when you say video engineer, then it was all about, for you, it was about, it was electronics. It was analog signals.
It was just, yeah, there wasn't much digital going on at that point. There were paint boxes and things like that. Another group at the BBC that I nearly worked at was the computer graphics workshop. But when I went to interview them, they basically, most of their funding came from doing election graphics, which was every 5 years.
Right.
And they were saying, yes, we're all revved up for the next election. And this was 88, and the next election didn't happen until 91. So I would have spent 3 years working on graphics for one night.
Not a lot to do.
Well, no, they did weather graphics and other things as well, but that was their big thing. And I was like, wow. Nah. And they had this really weird system. They had, like, the Quantel paint boxes, which were
right.
These... visual effects units that were digital and worked in a really weird way. They basically worked by having the video picture in RAM and then changing the addressing of the RAM to warp the picture.
Oh my goodness.
And they used the raster scan of the TV to refresh the RAM as well. It was this like amazing, wow. Hodgepodge. And they had an API to that that was private that nobody else had. And then they had some external Macs that you would write this Pascal to control the Quantel paint box to do the graphics. So it was just like, that was what you had to do TV quality graphics in those days.
Right.
So that was that group. And I didn't end up going to work with that group because of that. I went to this other group that was doing this sort of weird, not quite TV, not quite video stuff. And then shortly after that, sorry.
You had the PET before this, though. So you were aware of digital technology and computers and the potential of computers.
What kind of things did you do on your PET?
What's going to do with the PET? The PET only had character graphics. It didn't have a bitmap graphic.
Right.
One of the things I did, I had some friends at the computer club who were hardware hackers, and they built a thing that would let you put RAM where the character chip was. So we could modify the characters there. So I end up doing software for that let you edit the characters and produce non-character graphics on the screen.
So you were an early hacker then.
So I was hacking with that stuff.
Yeah.
What else did I do with that? I built a D2A converter so I could do digital music on it. And there was some software you could... Basically, the PET didn't have audio output. There were two ways you could get audio out. One was you could put a... There was a serial bit you could attach to it, and you would get a square wave out of that, and that was how you did sound. But they also had a parallel port that was 8-bit, and so if you put power of two resistors across that and connect that to a signal, you can, and then change the data on the parallel port quickly enough, you can get audio out.
Huh.
So I built one of those, had some software to do audio generation and stuff like that. So we were playing around with the hardware side as well as the software side even back then. But that was 10 years before. 8 years before, it was like 1980 or so. Mm. And so this group at the BBC was still trying to work out, what this was. The stuff they'd done Doomsday with was, insane. It was a VAX that they'd used to store the data on. It was their mainframe stuff. That, and at the turn in 1990, that group spun out from the BBC as a separate company. Called Multimedia Corporation, with the goal of doing whatever it was at this sort of junction of video and computing, but as a commercial organization, not as a sort of state-funded one like the BBC was at the time. And I went with them then. And that was where we were sort of experimenting with actually having computers that could display the, get at the pixels rather than just take a video signal and route it through to the screen. So the first batch of that was all done with overlay guards, where you'd have the external video under control and you'd overlay something on it. And then later we gradually got to do actual digital video and stuff like that as well. So it started out doing quite a few things that were like museum installations where we could get, install three big projectors and video displayers, synchronize them with a serial control and have a touch screen to manipulate them and do stuff like that. And then in parallel doing some CD-ROM stuff for the sort of early CD-ROM platforms that were around then.
Well, and how did this end up? I mean, museum's a good example of one way this ends up out in the public. Is, what kinds of CD-ROM stuff were people able to take advantage of? Because this is early, early days of CD-ROM.
Apple had started shipping CD-ROM drives as an external peripheral. They weren't built into machines yet. So there was an external device that was, you know, sort of that big that you would plug into the computer over the SCSI port, and then you had to hook the audio up separately. The audio didn't come through the computer. So you have this sort of gear that you had to plug into it. And you couldn't... if you were playing CD audio, you couldn't read data. So if you wanted to use the actual audio on the CD, you couldn't read data at the same time. So you had to choose between the two. So there were things... Do you remember the Beethoven's ninth CD-ROM thing? Leo might remember this.
Yeah. Wait a minute. That's coming back to me. You know, it's funny. In the early 90s, a regular weekly segment on a public broadcasting show in which I would review CD-ROM titles. At the time, everybody thought this is the future of publishing.
Yeah,
and there were museum tours. Who did the Beethoven's fifth? Was it a Criterion or something? Anyway,
Voyager. So Voyager was early on in this thing. Bob Stein.
And they did a lot of Laserdiscs as well. They did some amazing stuff. Interactive, and the web killed all this stuff because it was. You don't need it anymore.
South by Southwest Interactive began as South by Southwest CDs. Multimedia, which was all about CD-ROMs.
Isn't that funny?
And then they made the same jump. They said, oh, wait a minute, the web is where I'm
You staying. Guys are too young to sound like old farts, but you are, I got to tell you.
Well, that's, you know, this is the thing. So the CD-ROM thing, so it started out as external devices, and then they got built into the computers with the later models. But these were things that people were buying for, you know, $50-$70. They cost quite a bit in those days. And there was a market for them. But also what we found was that there was a market for the companies who were making these. They wanted to bundle some with a device. And if you get in on that deal, then that was you know, more guaranteed income, even though they would pay less per unit for it. So we did a bunch of... Do you remember the 3DO?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I loved the 3DO.
So the 3DO
I had a 3DO. I loved that. It was a game machine. Trip Hawkins, that was his that was his company. Now, of course, he went on to EA, but...
Well, it was owned by EA, or...
I think... It was, well, anyway, yeah.
At the point we were dealing with them in the mid-90s, it was owned by EA, and Trip was there. Or was it that EA was publishing for this, but through some sort of, you know, backhanded deal? Anyway, EA said, we're launching this 3DO thing... We need some stuff. We need the games, but we also need some educational titles because this educational thing is one of the ways where we get people to spend so much money on a device. So you've done these great, you know, museum things. One of the things we did in the museum was called Erdzicht, which was simulated flyovers of the globe without environmental stories. So you'd see this flyover, and then you'd hit an icon, it would fly down and tell you a story and then fly back up again.
Long before Google Earth, right?
There's a story I'll get to in a bit there. Yeah,
all right.
But so we did this. So we pitched them this idea of 3D atlas. Of okay, you want educational titles? Some we make you an encyclopedia. We'll make you an atlas, and we'll build you the whole globe that you can turn and zoom. And then when you zoom in, you will have video and audio stories and things that tell you about the places you're looking at. And they were keen on this for 3DO, but we also did a Mac version because we all had Macs, and Mac. Had a decent install base of CD-ROM drives in this was like 92, 93 when we started this one. And that was the sort of the breakout CD-ROM product that worked for us in that we decided to actually make it actually software and not just storytelling, if you see what I mean. Most of the CD-ROM stuff was saying, okay, we're TV producers. We're going to try and pretend we can do TV in this, even though the video is like this big. They didn't quite work. There wasn't a sense of an application to it. Whereas we built it actually as a Mac app and then the 3DO version with the idea that you could turn the globe anywhere and zoom in and out and, you know, measure things and have do some kinds of mapping stuff with it. Wow. That's an ancient rendering.
You could thank Chad for all of this. He's fast on the draw.
He's very impressive.
Yeah.
This is one of the
this is a 3DO title.
This is the 3DO version. Yeah.
Yeah.
So we had
I could tell because of the crappy
globe,
graphics.
A physical globe, and a... It was only 322.40.
Yeah, but you know what? For its time, it was pretty amazing.
Yeah, those seeing pictures look like pictures at the time was impressive.
Yeah, so we could turn the globe in all directions. That's actually giving the demo for me. And zoom in and out, overlay countries and just stuff like that. And then there were stories there, and then we had a quiz game thing of like, can you match the country with the flag and stuff like that.
And were you in software at this point, or were you still working?
Yeah. So this was a Multimedia Corporation. We were building this.
Right. And what were you writing it in? I mean, it's not HyperCard or something.
This was running stuff in C. Yeah, we had to.
You had to code it from the ground up.
Yeah, and we did the same for the Mac version. We coded that in C as well, which made it was much more responsive than building it in Director or any of these other sort of layered environments.
Right.
And we built our own. At this point, they can show the stats. So much fun. I wrote this. I love this. This was, we took all the data from the World Resource Institute, and which was like several thousand different kinds of statistics, and then overlaid them on the globe and let you color the globe with them. And then we'd also had, we had like different views. We would let you combine two stats so that you could actually do one over the other or something like that, which gave you a bunch of other stuff. We also would do a time series of the stuff changing over time, and used each country's flag as the data point so you could see as stuff moved. So you could. I had a lot of fun building this out of this sort of ridiculously low-res thing.
In hindsight, this looks kind of simple and trivial, and yet you got to remember what a huge deal this was at the time. I mean, these kinds of visualizations, you couldn't.
We're used to $700.
These
satellite map,
high
resolution.
But this is pre-Google Earth. I mean, this is pretty impressive stuff.
Well, we did use satellite imagery. We worked with University College London, which was a research university there that did the satellite imagery. So they would get the satellite imagery and reconstruct these kinds of flights for us, and also construct the whole globe. I think this one will like zoom in, and then it overlays a higher res satellite image and shows you some detail there as well. There was some stuff like this that were sort of pre-rendered ones, but there were whole globes with varying levels of zoom that we could show things, and we had some cities that were in higher res. That we basically treated as flat.
What year was this?
93, 94, yeah.
Yeah, so I mean, think about that. Compared to what you're used to now on the web, I mean, this is pretty darn close all the way back then.
Yeah,
at a time when like most of the CD-ROMs and multimedia stuff that I remember had maybe a little postage stamp type picture that was sort of bitmap looking. And
I want to jump forward a little bit. So
that was one of the things we did on the Mac, was that we decided we would use 16-bit graphics instead of 8-bit graphics. Because all the Macs that were launching were coming out with 16-bit graphics. Right. Which meant that we could actually have
16-bit color or resolution.
16-bit color. Yeah.
Okay.
And it was still 64480 or less, 512384 resolution. But the graphics, because they actually had 16-bit graphics, it meant we could do video that looked better, and we could build a user interface that had more style to it. Could use gradients. Could do subtle stuff because you weren't always worrying about pixels. And then when we did that, that was a huge hit with Apple, and Apple was then very keen to bundle this because it showed off the graphics for the title, whereas most every other title was focused on 8-bit at most, or less. This was just about Windows 3 time, and the PCs had 8-bit or 4-bit graphics if you wanted that many pixels.
Did CyberNations come out of this, or is this just something you've always been interested in?
The geography stuff?
Yeah. I mean, the CyberNations game. Did this come...
I don't know what you mean. Sorry.
It says there's a massively multiplayer game invented by Kevin Marks. Maybe it's a different Kevin Marks.
Ah.
Are you the creator of CyberNations, an online nation simulation game?
You haven't. How could Wikipedia be so wrong?
My Wikipedia says what?
I'm afraid you're mistaken, Kevin. Wikipedia says you do know about cyber days.
Well, what's interesting, because this, it sounds like something you would have been interested in. It says, created by Kevin Mark's model in the game he invented as a child involving a world map and pushpins. It sounded like you've been doing this stuff since you were a kid.
This is weird. Okay, I should read this. This is fascinating.
Not that Kevin Marks, apparently.
That's probably what it is.
Although it's linked right out of your Wikipedia
page. Yeah, so, okay, if someone wants to fix that, that's cool, because it's not me.
Okay, we'll fix that. not me, although I could see why somebody would be confused, because it's very similar to the kind of stuff. Yeah. When did you go to work for Apple? Was that right out of this?
So what happened was we built these CD-ROM things. The 3D Outs one was enormously successful. Some of the other ones were... that suddenly meant, oh, we should do more of these things. But it was actually quite hard to do something of that scope. We did some encyclopedic ones. We did some other ones based on books that we were trying to do the same kind of thing to. But this was coming up to the time when the web was gaining in importance.
Right.
So by, 1996, 97, it was fairly clear to those of us who were, on the technical side that the web was going to take this thing over. But we had these year-long contracts to make these CD-ROMs. They were million-dollar projects. They would take about a year, and you had to hit the shipping window.
And they sell 50 copies. I mean, the whole thing just collapsed.
Well, we did better. We were doing better than that because we had these bundle deals and we had these things. But there was a presumption that the others would do as well as 3D Atlas, which was a bit.
That was the one.
An assumption.
Yeah, that was the one.
Ended up being your peak.
Yeah.
Well, we had some follow-ups that did well too. But but the other thing was that we were also on this sort of. Classic game royalty type contract with EA where they had first dibs on any sequels and they would reinvest the recoupment into the next thing. So I learned a lot about annoying industry contracts from that.
Well, we all have to learn sometime. Better to learn early than late.
What was happening was that the web was catching up with what these things were able to do, and that,
right.
And eventually, like Christmas '96, it was fairly clear that actually the web was what mattered and what these weren't, and suddenly this wasn't viable anymore. And so we tried, we changed what we were doing in the company. We're doing more web work and so on, but the production skills that we had were focused on these sort of very high production value video things, native code engineering, that kind of stuff. And it wasn't really a great fit for building like 1996 era websites where if you had an animated GIF, you were doing well in the visual side.
Under construction.
And you were back down to 8-bit and web safe palette, all that stuff again. So that, that was one of those like technology transitions that's really hard to deal with. And this company didn't deal with it very well. Because they were, they were hooked on these expensive big productions. We weren't quite geared up to do many shorter web style productions. And we'd at this point we'd gone public, and we ended up with some bankers who ended up in control of the company and decided they'd rather shut it down and use our previous losses to fund something else than keep it going.
That's really sad.
So that was very sad. So we went from, 50 of us down to, I was the last one there trying to tidy up the last few hungover CD projects that were still there. So that was very sad. Mm. And from that, I went over these 7 or 8 years, we've been working with Apple and working with the QuickTime team to integrate video into our applications. And we were, they knew us fairly well because we were always trying to do things that it couldn't quite do yet. And so I talked to the...
You heard the guy calling saying, if it could only... they were going, yeah, there he is again.
But,
No, that's good. I think that's how products improve, is the users, especially great users like I'm sure you were, help, say, drive the product and a good company will listen.
But also there was the QuickTime dev mailing list, which was...
Right.
Where the QuickTime engineers and the developers talk to each other.
Boy, that seems like the kind of thing that you wouldn't see anymore at Apple.
It's rarer now, but we didn't have, this was the web was barely there. We had Apple Link, but we had a mailing list that we could discuss stuff on, and I was on there telling people how to do things. So I always found odd ways to do things that didn't quite work or whatever. And I'd go to Apple Developer Conferences every year and and visit them and show them our stuff and talk about it. Right. So the QuickTime guy said, "Oh, you're looking around for work? Come interview with us." So
awesome.
I came over about this time of year. It was Thanksgiving 97 it was. And came over and met them. And it was weird because it was one of the first times I had those experience. You know, they have that experience where you've been talking to someone online, then you meet them face to face. And the interviews were like that, because suddenly it was like, oh, you're that guy on the list.
Yeah, right.
Oh, I know what you know. Okay, let me ask you about this.
You're sort of famous to me. I know who you are.
Right.
Well, I'd somehow made friends with a bunch of guys, 8,000 miles away in a different time zone. Mm-hmm. Some of which I met face to face. I'm exaggerating a little bit, but there were a chunk of people there. It was like, oh, you're that name from the main list who doesn't normally get up on stage at developer conference, but right. I know you. You know me.
Right. Right.
So I'd somehow managed to make a connection over the net, and so that they said come to California, work for Apple, and so it was like, yeah, that sounds like a great idea. We did.
I'll be right there.
Had two little kids. Had a 1-year-old and a 3-year-old. We ourselves. Moved over here, but
that's quite a bold move. So, what did you do? What were your responsibilities on that team?
So, on QuickTime, it was kind of odd because they hired me this time of year, but we had to wait for the visa. So, when I actually came over the next April, a bunch of things had changed. Steve Jobs had come back and taken over. That was a change.
A big change. Yeah,
they'd actually just shipped QuickTime 3. So, the week I turned up, most of the team wasn't there. There were only a few of them there, which was kind of odd. Like, oh yeah, you're the new guy. Here's your office. Everyone's just taken 2 weeks
right
off as we shipped. So that was kind of weird. But the first thing I worked on was the app that was the DVD player app. So this was when Apple was just starting to put DVDs in the machines. Mm-hmm. And it's the irony. It was like at that time they weren't going through the digital stuff. They had their own separate channel and were doing overlays onto the screen. So it was like being in a video disc land again. Mm-hmm. It was like you couldn't actually get at the pixels of the thing. They had a special decoding hardware. And there was a bunch of stuff to work on with that. So I ended up working on that app and doing some bits and pieces on that. And then I came back to my desk one day and there was a marker pen scrawl on my screen saying, "Come and find me, Peter." and this was Peter Hoddy, who was the chief engineer of the QuickTime team. And he said, and I went to see him and he said, "Oh, okay, we've got the developer conference coming up in a week. And we want to show off our new streaming video stuff. But when we showed it to Steve, he said, what do you mean you can't capture video and do it live? You can only do pre-recorded stuff. We need to do something live. So we need to build a demo showing that we can do live video capture. And well, I nominate you to help us do this."
Okay.
So the streaming team had been working for 2 years building this nice, solid standards-based streaming stuff, a streaming server and the client software. It was one of those times where Apple went with a standardized route. So
what was the standard at the time? Was it HTTP streaming or was it?
No, it was RTP, real-time RTP streaming.
RTP.
So this was, if you remember See You See Me.
Yes.
It was also the standard used for doing video telephony, audio telephony as well. So it's UDP based. It's not TCP based.
Okay.
Is it an H.dot, like a H.324 or 323?
Those specify different levels of codecs. So there was H.263 was one of the codecs that was there, but 264 didn't exist yet.
I see.
There was H.
We don't even know the exact standard, but it was standard.
There were interchangeable codecs for audio and video, and then there were rules for how you churn data into packets and put them into packets on the wire, and each packet was designed to be individually losable without causing cascade losses. In effect,
right, like UDP works, right?
Yeah, it was UDP. RTP is UDP with an extra header.
Gotcha.
So each audio and video packet was sent out as a separate packet. And you didn't try and retransmit generally, because the assumption was your latency was low enough.
You can miss a packet
make it
here
up.
Or there.
Yeah.
And also the assumption was that it wasn't that compressed, so each packet was only 20 milliseconds, so you could just repeat the previous one, and the audio doesn't sound too bad. And then the thing that the QuickTime guys had done and said, okay, actually doing this in real time is kind of hard, but if we assume we're only doing one-way streaming most of the time, if we're doing something that is like watching watching a show where you're not interacting, so like the audience is watching us now, that streaming has a buffer in it,
right?
Or if you're watching a movie playback or something like that over the network, then we can afford to put a bit of more buffer on the client. If we put a 3-second buffer there, we can actually cope with anything. We can by relaxing that latency constraint a bit, we can actually have some codecs that aren't actually tuned for this and make them work too. So they did that. So they had this whole system built, but Jobs said, "But if you can't do live transmission, this is pointless. Build the live transition thing."
Do you think he was right about that? I know it was harder to do.
It's interesting. He was right. He was definitely right in terms of the demo, because we built the demo and the demo was great. It's up on the net somewhere. What I had to do was I had to hook up the video capture software to the encoding and packaging bit they already had, which they'd done for offline, and just create a stream that then the ordinary client could play. So we had this sort of magic transmitter that would create something that the clients can play. And then that worked. That was demoed at the... Was it the 97 developer conference or the 98 developer conference? I think it was the 97 developer conference.
That QuickTime streaming server? Was that what they called it at the time?
This was QuickTime Broadcaster.
Broadcaster, okay.
Well, this wasn't actually QuickTime, but this was a grotesque hack. And then QuickTime Broadcaster was what I then worked on.
It was the predecessor to the actual program.
Now that you've demoed it, build it.
Now that we've demoed this, can you actually make this? Okay, now we've designed system software for this and an app, blah, blah, blah. Right,
right. But I don't know many people use it, but they still ship it on Apple, on Macintosh server, right?
Yeah, no, I mean, this is one of these things. This was one of those weird things where that assumption that they said, well, if we had a 3-second buffer, we can make this better, was one of those weird things where, and then you start doing retransmission and then you suddenly find you've reinvented TCP and actually you should be using TCP for this.
Oh, rats.
Because
I hate it when that happens.
we built this product that let you do, you know, live broadcasting from your Mac anywhere.
Right.
And that there weren't that many applications for it. We had this sort of weird thing where we built this thing, what use is it? And the thing is that a lot of the use of the kind of thing we're doing now is having some kind of back channel and conversation, so there's something else going on too.
That's
so
why you would want to do it live.
If you want to do it live, you need the chat room there to give you feedback and talk to them.
Right.
You need that kind of stuff going on. And if you look at the successful streaming things now, like Quick and those ones, they all have that. They all have that idea
it's built in.
I've said this, but yeah. I've got a back channel.
Yeah.
And that was, so we built this and it was like, well, what is this actually good for? The sort of the streaming server part was kind of made some sense, but actually using a web server was better. It actually performed better.
Really? Now, wow, that's interesting. It performed, which would be HTTP streaming.
Yeah.
Well, performed better.
This was a huge fight at the time. So one of the things I did there was, we know QuickTime had fast start video playback since before I got there, since early 90s.
Right.
Which Love was basically
that. You'd start a download, but it would be able to play immediately.
Yeah,
and that was HTTP based.
Yes, it would. It was HTTP 1 based. It would start downloading the file. It would look at how much it got and how much it had left to go, and estimate if it could download it or not, and then start playing through.
Right.
They built this. I helped tune bits of it as well, but that was something that had been there for a long time. But this was on the presumption that you don't random access. You only just pull from the beginning and keep downloading, because HTTP 1 didn't have random access.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if you have HTTP 1.1, that was when they said, oh, you can read this bit from the middle of the file, so you could actually skip back and forth. And that was one of the features.
And there's the problem.
And this is UDP failing.
With the UDP. We just dropped you for a second. You're back. Actually, that's a Wi-Fi issue.
Should have used UDP.
Too many packets.
Too many packets, yeah. So one of the things I hacked on there was, this suddenly became obvious, and talking to my friend Stuart Cheshire at Apple there, who was a networking guy, was like, well, you know, TCP is just a file stream. There's nothing that says you have to do it that way. You can seek inside that and it will work. And if you mounted a you know, a server over web dev, you were effectively doing that and the stuff would play off it. So I did it. I wrote a data handler that just used HTTP as the transport and looked like a file system, and we built that and that worked. And that was the reason we built that demo was for the iTunes playback. When iTunes could playback the stuff nearby, how should it do that, right? And the group that had built the streaming server says, oh, you need a streaming server to do this. We need to build this infrastructure. And Stuart and I were like, well, no, you can just play the files off the other machine. And so the demo the open the lid and the... Stuart was working on Bonjour, the let you find nearby computer stuff. So the, oh, I open the lid of this laptop and suddenly my machine appears in iTunes, I can play the music off that. That was what we had together to demo that. That was a few years later. But that was, you know, that was suddenly realizing that actually treating the web as a file system worked better than pretending that something that was real time wasn't. Mm. You see what I mean? So the original video protocol for streaming was designed for a two-way conversation like Skype, like this kind of chat we're having now, with the assumption that latency is paramount. Because if you have more than a few hundred milliseconds of latency when you're talking to somebody, the conversation breaks up.
Right.
You start having to sort of say over, you can't interrupt, you can't, you know.
Right. So was it a choice between file seeking and latency?
Yeah. So it's a question of what are you optimizing for? And the problem is that the TV companies were used to a low latency world. Because when television was invented, there wasn't enough RAM in the world to buffer a video image.
Right.
Right?
Right.
So the assumption was always, oh, we are sending a signal out and no one's buffering, they're just watching it. And this was getting less and less true, but their mindset was still, we're sending a live stream out. We had right. a series of channels. And so what we ended up modeling was that worldview where we put the streaming system that would do that. Whereas what was actually valuable was turning those things into files, you know, so that you have access to it. So you have a Netflix-type situation or a YouTube-type situation where you don't all have to watch the same thing at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So there was this, and, you know, and eventually, you know, the iTunes was the realization of that as well, in effect. iTunes was, we should sell songs and later videos as standalone files that people can choose to play as a whole. But this sort of combination of this, telephony is real time and television is real time, so we should use the same kind of model for both. Mm-hmm. And therefore, we should model the video and audio transmission on the computer as if it was telephony, had low buffering. It took a long time to realize that this was actually a bad idea. And having built a chunk of it and done this, it was like, actually, this streaming server is not that useful compared to a web server. Because the thing is, you always... you always want to have if the thing at the other end is fixed, you want as big a buffer as possible, and the biggest buffer that's possible is download the whole file,
right?
And then if you don't have enough space local to hold the file, you want at least enough that you can have a sort of blip in network connectivity and not get a blip in playback,
right?
And that is the weird part is this debate is still going on now, 10 years later. There's was it the ITF. The ITF, the W3C video group, and we're still talking about adaptive streaming and stuff like that, and saying, oh, we need adaptive streaming. It's like, why do you need adaptive streaming? So we can switch the quality on the fly when the network connection goes out. It's like, well, you only need that if you're not buffering enough. Why are you not buffering enough? You know,
or if you want to be low latency live.
If you want to be low latency live, okay, fair. If you want to be low latency live, or, you know, or even medium latency live, you know, you can still use... You don't have to do something that's too clever if you're just watching something like Twit, because there's still 10, 15 seconds of delay,
right?
On the way out, and that's enough to.
That's close enough for a chat room to work,
right?
Yeah,
not to have a conversation, but for a chat room to work.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah, it's a question of what the perceived lag is.
Although it's ruined the ability to watch something and then turn down the sound and listen to something else. Nothing sticks anymore.
Yes. Well, that's it. The number of years of my life I lost a bloody sink, I tell you.
Yeah. We just wish we had Genlock. That's all. We just want Genlock.
Well, this point about buffering is what I was saying, is that before nothing, you couldn't buffer, so you couldn't lose sync, right?
Right.
Whereas then we became able to buffer audio, so therefore we could delay the audio and not the video. But now every video frame you look at has been buffered at least three times, because even on the TV, the display is a buffer that it's going to from that. So there's at least a one frame delay there. And if you're doing MPEG decoding, they send the frames out of sequence, so you need to have at least...
Really? They send keyframes, and then they send...
You send a keyframe. You have keyframes, you have prediction frames, and you have bidirectional prediction frames. So you have a keyframe and a keyframe. Keyframe, right. And keyframe. In the middle here, you have an intermediate frame,
right,
that's protected from the keyframe.
Right.
And then in here, you have bidirectional frames that go between those two.
And they don't arrive in order.
So you have to send the keyframe, the B frame, and the... Sorry, the keyframe, the P frame, and then the B frames in between.
Right.
So you need to have at least whatever spacing between that delay to decode the MPEG.
Right.
Which is why when you switch channels on a digital cable box, there's that gap before it.
Yeah.
It can show you anything.
Wow, I had no idea that was
because it's interpreting those B frames in between, right?
Yeah, and if you just show the B frames, you get weird pixel noise.
Yeah.
Because it's trying to interpret. It's trying to do. You sometimes see that when you come into the middle of a stream, you see like someone's face texture mapping out of a gray background.
Oh, you step in all the time on digital cable. Right. They've gotten it down a little bit.
Yeah. They buffer probably.
They buffer a bit more. Yeah. What they do now is they'll buffer before you switch. But
right.
Anyway, the point is you will... There's still this thing of, this is the way you do it. And we've gradually moved to a file-based world where actually you do it... if you're watching something that has been pre-recorded, there's absolutely no reason for you to watch it live.
Right.
But the interesting thing I'm seeing now is that...
So then you store and forward. You do everything...
Yeah.
Download.
Yeah. Yeah. Or even, if you just treat the thing as a file server and pull it over the network in big chunks rather than in fractions of a second chunks.
Got it.
But I know people resist that sometimes because they think it's more bandwidth intensive to do that.
Exactly the same amount of bandwidth, right? It's precisely the same number of bits.
What they worry about is that somebody stops watching and then they've spent a lot of time buffering a bunch of stuff that they're not going to watch.
Yeah, yes and no. I mean, the thing is, it's trading off bandwidth versus latency all the time. And the thing that you want is to have an interrupt-free experience. So, the right answer would be for to do it on a chapter-by-chapter basis. Right?
Right. So then you only download a chapter. Yeah. You never more than a chapter access.
Unlike everything apart from this show, all things very like this show actually have meaningful chunks and stops in them. I suppose this show does too, because we look...
Well, it's going to. Unfortunately, we're not even caught up. We're not even a quarter of the way through your career, and we have to stop now.
We've reached the end of our buffer.
Our buffer is overflowed. I wanted to ask you how Flash did this.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you about Technorati. He invented podcasting. Adam Curry finally admitted that. and then we didn't even get to the modern era and standards, micro formats, British Telecom, J.P. Rangaswamy, and Salesforce.com. And so we're going to have to get you back another time. How about that?
Okay, we can do that.
I just love talking to Kevin, and it gets sometimes a little abstruse. I hope we didn't get you too abstruse. We didn't even get to the commercial. So let me just mention, before we let him go, the folks at Ford, Ford.com. I was having too much fun. Ford.com/technology. You know why? Because I was learning something about streaming that I didn't even know. Here we are doing it, and I didn't even know
how it
worked.
That's the best part about this show, is we learn so many things for what we do from our guests.
Yeah. Fascinating stuff. And I know probably most of you are just glazing over, but Nick H., 30, who works in satellite and streaming and transport, was fascinated in the chat room. We know that. You did not overgeek, Kevin. I would have stopped you if you did. We love that stuff. Ford.com/technology. Speaking of overgeeks, we love advertisers that are geeks. And Ford, geeky as all get out. You could probably thank Alan Mulally for that. Certainly, he really revitalized Ford when he joined as CEO. Some years back, he came from Boeing, where he was an engineer, designed the 777 cockpit. And all of a sudden, I don't know if it's a coincidence, all of a sudden, these Ford automobiles have the latest, greatest, coolest technology in there. Things like Ford Sync with My Ford Touch that gets you where you're going efficiently, effectively. This is nice. You know, with other GPSs, I'll do a point of interest or a POI search, and they never have where you want to go. Now they've got 40 in the new Ford My Ford Touch, 40 million businesses. Everything's in there. So you just say, I want to go to Twit. It not only knows where, it gives the phone number. You can make a call to Twit.
It's got us in there.
You know, I didn't check, but I'm sure it has us. 40 million businesses must have us. Has everybody. They've obviously, you know, decided, you know, we really ought to get all of the databases at Foursquare and all these other companies. They probably use Simple Geo. That would be the way that I would
They got the app platform.
That's exactly right. I mean, if you take a look, the idea here, of course, is to keep your hands on the wheel, your eyes on the road, so you're safe, but you still communicate with the outside world, and Sync does it so well. You even have a way that if you're on Google Maps or MapQuest, you can plan like a 14-stop trip and send it to the car.
Which, I love that because that's how when I go on trips, I always start on Google Maps at home,
right?
And then I have to reproduce it on my phone.
Exactly.
But you don't have to with this.
You don't have to. You even have an account. They call it your Sync Traffic Directions and Information Systems account, where you send that information to. It will do things. There's an app for Android and iPhone. It will send that information to the app. It will text message you with traffic problems on your route that's coming up, things like that. It's very sophisticated, very cool, and you have to have it in your next vehicle. But the only way to do that is to go to a Ford dealer right now and drive one. Ford.com/technology is the website, and I'm so excited. I'll let you ride in it. I got word I'm going to be getting that 2012 electric Focus.
Oh, yeah?
I'm excited. I think they got an influencers thing that Scott Monty said, we'll get you on the list. Nice. So I'm excited. I cannot wait.
Great.
I'm really excited. You can take a look at the 2012 Ford Focus at your Ford dealer right now and see all the great stuff that Sync and My Ford Touch does. Ford.com/technology if you want to see it on the web. And we thank Ford for their support for triangulation. It makes it possible for us to interview great people like Kevin Marks. Of all the jobs, Kevin, that you've had, all the places that you've worked, we're going to leave your current employer out because, of course, you would want to say them just out of, you know, being a good employee. Leave out Salesforce.
We'll assume Salesforce.
We'll assume Salesforce.
That's taken as read.
Which job was the most fun for you?
It's interesting. I mean, the startup thing is always the most energy.
Sure
and I got to do that twice. I did that with Multimedia Corporation, and that was very intense, and discovering things and making stuff as we go along and inventing video before it could work. And I had got to do that again with Technorati with blogging and saying, oh, let's build a search engine. How hard can that be? So that was, as you say, maybe I'll come back and talk about that another time. But both of those experiences, debate this week with Michael Arrington and Jamie Zawinski about working really hard is the essence of startups and whatever. Jamie pushed back, and then Mike said, no, actually, being really obsessed with it is what the essence of startups is. And I think that's it. It's like, there's this thing that is fascinating, and I can't wait to get up and work on that. And that feeling of intensity is enormously exciting. And I got to do that with the Motor Media Corporation, where we were, you know, making stuff out of whole cloth, and I got to do it again with Technorati. With Apple, there were some elements of that too. We were, you know, inventing things there, but it wasn't that same. There's, you know, 10 of us in this room. We're going to make this thing. That is always a.
But even when you worked at BT and did Ribbit, that was kind of your own thing within the big giant BT sphere, right? So you're still, in a way, doing your own projects.
Yes, no, I'm still doing my own projects. But that, I came in after they'd been bought. They'd been through that phase, and that wasn't.
So why
my...
not do another startup?
I'm getting old.
What's the maximum age? Because I think I hit it.
That's not fair. I think it's easy to do that stuff. It is easy to do that when you're younger.
It is.
But it's also finding the thing that you're obsessed about enough to do that. And one of the things I found working with Google and BT and Salesforce was there are other ways that you can make a dent in the world, change the world by doing some of these things that you change the protocols and the ideas that people are using. That's been interesting too, without actually having to build everything yourself.
Right.
Part of the value of the cloud worldview is you don't have to put everything yourself anymore. You can say, oh, there are all these pieces, I can join these up, or there's a missing PC, we need to add something here, without having to do everything. You know, when we did the 3D Atlas, we wrote the whole thing from the ground up in C. We had a bit of operating system support on the Mac, we had a small amount of operating system support on the 3DO, but big chunks of that we were making up as we went along. You know, we had to design our own file formats, we had to design our own text layout engines, we had to do our own graphics mixing and blending, we had to, you know, build big chunks of stuff from scratch because you couldn't delegate that. And for the value of the cloud stuff is that you can now delegate big chunks of what you want to do to something that's either already been written in an open source way or a service that already exists that will do that for you. Yeah. So that change has been fascinating for me as well.
Yeah, we've gotten to the point where collaboration is really the key.
It's an object-oriented world.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's fat.
Well, it's more of a service-oriented world.
Mm-hmm.
Object orientation ends up really, really tightly bound. Mm-hmm. Because you've got to really know the API of stuff. Whereas now it's like we've got these abstractions that are more flexible than that.
Boy, I'd love you to have come back and we'll talk about that because that's a really interesting subject too. You just have to come back, Kevin.
I'd love to. I always enjoy talking to you, Leo.
It's really fun. Kevin Marks' blog is at j.mp/k. How about that for a short URL? Otherwise, it's a payus.blogspot.com. Either way, it's good. Well worth reading. He's a very thoughtful guy. Always a welcome guest on our shows.
I've had a blog for 10 years now. I actually missed that. So I need to go and write some more essays.
Yeah, blogging is, it's an interesting thing. I just was reading Om Malik's 10th anniversary blog post.
I just saw that.
Yeah, and it's inspiring. And it's true. If you do it continuously and you write a lot, as he does, you create a body of work that's very interesting.
Well, I find I do that. I'll be talking about something and I'll send someone a link to a blog post I wrote 5 years ago because it's like, oh yeah, I've written about this before. And as I haven't been writing as many recently because I've been twittering more and doing more of these live things, I'm probably sort of exhausting my store of like, oh, I've thought about this, written about it. So yeah, I should see if I can write at least once a week as opposed to three times a day.
Yeah, once a week would be good.
Set myself an achievable goal.
Yeah, exactly. Great to talk to you. Kevin Marks, thank you for joining us on Triangulation. Thank you for being here. We do this show 4 p.m. Pacific time every Wednesday or whenever we get a great guest, 7 p.m. Eastern time. And I guess if I say 4 plus 12 is 16, add 9 is 3 a.m. UTC, which means no one's going to watch us in Britain. But you can always see it after the fact.
But UTC is handy for people in India.
Yeah, no, that's why I do UTC. It's all over the world. But if you are, if we're in the middle of the night for you, don't forget, we have this on the web.
It's midnight UTC.
It's midnight?
Yeah.
Am I doing this all wrong now?
4 p.m. plus 8, yeah.
Oh, I am.
You did 9.
I did 9.
But then you added
thinking British time, but nevertheless, I screwed it up badly. So
British time is UTC at this time of year.
Oh, that's right, because it's summertime.
Because the
it's no, not summertime. Anyway,
we just need one time zone for everyone.
Yeah, I don't care what time of day it is. You can always watch us at twit.tv/TRI.
Exactly.
There you go.
Store it.
Store and forward. Who needs streaming anyway? Thank you for being here, Kevin. Thank you all for being here. We'll see you next time on Triangulation.